Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon. I'm excited to preside over another good discussion today. We have one fewer panelist than usual. In this case, our topic is kind of the biggest news in probably the Mormon blogging universe and just Mormons in the news today. It was generated by an article co-written by our guest, Darren Smith, along with a partner named Luke O'Brien, and it was in Deadspin blog, and it's called The Truth About Race, Religion, and the Honor Code at BYU. And so we've brought Darren on as our guest to talk about this, and I've drawn on my partner in crime, Joanna Brooks, to help lead a good discussion. So we thought with more of a topic that was about something that you can kind of get your brain around, it's a certain number of pages or screenshots or whatever you'd want to call it, a blog article these days. And then Joanna and I would try to take that article, and then our definite goal today is to broaden it to the wider discussion of race within the Mormon Church. How do we talk about race? How do we deal with race? How do we bring about change? What are the effective strategies, and all that stuff? So, Joanna, welcome as my co-host again.
Oh, Dan, thank you for having me. Everyone, thank you for listening.
Thanks. And as for those of you, you all already know Joanna. And you know what we ought to do, Joanna, is we need to put a little thing on our blog about, you know, just a short bio, and then we save our time each time. But Joanna's a very well-known blogger for Religion Dispatches. She also has a Ask Mormon Girl, which is now folded in under the Feminist Mormon Housewives things. And she's a professor at San Diego State University and a total star. Anyway, and Darren, you are well known to at least a lot of the podcast listeners, I think, that are sort of, you know, under the umbrella of the things that John Dolin created. I know you were a guest of Mormon Stories in the past. Since then, yeah, I think you finished your PhD at University of Utah, and you're now in Wichita. So why don't you give us just a quick update on your life, what you're doing these days, and kind of larger projects and whatnot that are going on.
You bet. You know, as all of you know, the economy has been terrible, and so I've been on the job market and applied for several different positions, and I was lucky enough to get a position here at Wichita State. And if you don't know what Wichita is or where it is, it's in Kansas. And if you follow basketball, college basketball, of course, you know that Wichita State won the NIT tournament this year. So that's
cool.
his local claim to fame.
Yay!
So I'm now officially a Shocker.
Sure. But you just started this fall, so you've just been there a few months.
I started in January, yeah. Exactly. In February, excuse me. So packed up my things and headed across the Rockies, and here I am in the Midwest.
Cool. So that's what you're doing for your job. What are you doing on the wider Mormon discussion front?
Well, I don't know if your listeners know this. I know you know this, Dan. Mormonism has always been a very interesting intellectual project for me, as well as being a practicing Mormon. But it's always been very interesting to look at Mormonism on broader issues. But mainly, one of my main focuses is actually race. Looking at race and Mormonism has always been something that's sort of moved me and sort of spoke to my soul. And so currently I'm working on a piece right now. I'm trying to get an article finished that I can actually get submitted. And then, of course, moving on to a larger book project, looking at questions of race and religion and sports at BYU. So this is kind of part of a larger issue that I've done in the past when I've looked at race, and then now moving on into race and the Mormon Church and the sports world. So.
Okay, and then remind us your connection at BYU. You're a BYU grad. I know you started at Ricks, which is now BYU-Idaho.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Then
yeah.
you... Yeah. And you were a football player there, right?
Well, no.
No, that's right. You weren't. That's right. Okay.
Yeah, I was much more interested in developing my brain.
Okay, good.
Although I didn't have a problem with my brawn, but but my brain is what I was after there. So.
Okay.
I had a great time up there. When it was Rick's, I had a great time there.
Right. So it was a 2-year university at the time. Then you came down and you graduated at BYU. And about what year was that?
I actually did a master's degree at BYU in education. And I finished there in 2000.
Okay. And then after that, you went up to the U of U for your doctorate. But I know you taught at BYU for quite a few years as an adjunct.
About 10 years there as an adjunct instructor there. And taught in sociology mainly, but also taught some courses in education as well.
Okay. Sounds good. So you're quite familiar with BYU. And some of the athletes and things you talked about here were friends and acquaintances while you were there, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Good. Good. Well, Joanna, if you're all right, I'm just going to ask Darren to dive right in and sort of give us a description of this article. What led you to write it? What were you? Was it a, you know? Yeah, just sort of the process of germinating it. And also tell us who Luke O'Brien is. I have never quite gotten, you know. It seems like you know. You're the one that's getting interviewed all the time. So who is Luke first?
Well, first of all, Luke works for Deadspin, so he's one of the bloggers at Deadspin, and so and you know just. You know, just how this all came about really was a conversation I had with a guy named Chad Nielsen. I don't know if you guys know who Chad is, but Chad actually writes for ESPN magazine, and I met Chad probably several years ago when he did the first story back in 2004, 2005 with the 14 athletes that were kicked out.
Right.
Chad came down to BYU to do a story about this, and he and I met, and he interviewed me, and we've made remained friends throughout this time, but. He had mentioned that Deadspin was going to do a piece on Brandon Davies and asked me to get involved with that and asked me to talk to the folks at Deadspin. I had no idea what Deadspin was or who it was or anything. I just, you know, Chad was a friend of mine. I figured I would, you know, go ahead and call him. And so we talked and they actually wanted just a little bit of a sort of a sociological analysis of what went on with Brandon Davies to kind of give him a summary of the sort of the church's position or at least try to make sense of the church's racial history as it pertained to Brandon Davies and what led to a paragraph turned into obviously a long piece on this topic. So as we got into this, it got more and more, I mean, literally as we got into this, the story kept spinning out in terms of not spinning in a bad way, but sort of growing as we became more and more intimate with the data. And we thought to ourselves, there's something here that has not been looked at before. And what's interesting about that too is I want to just make mention of this is that Chad Nielsen actually started doing this, compiling this data way back when. And Chad originally brought it to my attention and I was like, wow. You know, but obviously I couldn't really get on it because I was working on my PhD. And as you guys know, it takes time to write a dissertation and you still have any extra time to do anything like that. So I sort of put it off until now. I'm thinking, wow, this is a story that needs to be told. And so this is kind of how it came about.
Cool. And how much were you able to tell it the way you wanted to? How much would you say Deadspin wanted it a certain way? Was it pretty much, did you have final say on exactly what happened?
Well, you know, obviously when there's another entity involved, there's always compromises that have to be made. And so, but luckily, Luke has much integrity and kept me informed throughout the process of what was going on. So I was very involved in terms of reading drafts and making contributions to it. And again, getting my hands dirty in the actual data itself. So I would say for the most part, I had some say in it. But I think that the next go around will be a lot different.
And the next go around is the larger book that you're doing, or the article that you're trying to submit?
Both, okay. Actually both. So I think the article will be largely theoretical, and the book will be much more of a qualitative piece where I'll actually do, you know, a thorough research, I mean, thorough interviews with the athletes, actually go and interview them, sit down and actually have a conversation with them about all these issues.
Yeah.
Joanna, you want to jump in with any questions to kind of keep – I still want – I want him to go ahead and tell us the gist of the story, but is there anything?
No, that sounds ahead of time? Okay. That, go ahead. Let's get to tell the gist of the story.
Yeah. Yep. So what is it you guys discovered? What is it that you said this is a story that has to be told?
Well, just before I get there, the issue with Brandon Davies got on my last nerve. I'll just say that. I just, when I heard about that, I was like, here they go again. Why do they always, they being BYU, why do they always manage to land themselves in the media over some racial issue? Have they not learned their lessons from the past? So I began to look into the Davies issue. I'm saying, what's going on with Davies? And then I said, hold on a second. Let's go back and look at all the honor code violations that took place from, originally it was from, 2004. Started there and worked our way forward and said, okay, in 2004, there were some 40 athletes that were kicked out of BYU from 2004 to about 2010.
Brandon, so Brandon, Darren.
You call me Brandon. My name is Brandon.
Crud. Roll it back. I'm looking at my notepad and I'm getting messed up in the head. Darren, apologies.
When you say,
here we go again, your reaction when it landed in the news, what pattern of BYU's race troubles were you identifying this as an iteration of?
It always seems to be African Americans. They always seem to be captured in the news for some particular reason.
And you were thinking back to the 2004-2005 mass expulsions.
Right. Yeah. I went back, of course, as you know, there were two incidences of rape, one in 2004 and one in 2005.
Right.
I went back to that. I was like, okay, here we go again. And it had something to do with black men and sex.
Right.
And so I'm thinking to myself, there's something here. I mean, obviously there's a long history of black men being demonized and vilified over their sexual prowessness
in American culture.
In America,
right.
The West, in the larger West, not just America, but
European culture, American culture. It dates back to the Renaissance. Yes.
Right. You bet. And so this whole idea of black men and their perceived sexual prowessness, here it is, all plastered in the media.
Right. And so what LDS folks might see as, well, this is simply a case of, an isolated story of a kid who made a bad choice. When it lines up with these huge centuries old patterns that you see because you're a scholar of race and that other people see because they've lived them, right?
That's correct.
It's like, bam.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
And someone who's innocent to those patterns or who doesn't live intimately with those patterns might see it as, well, this is just an isolated incident, a kid who screwed up, who should have known better.
Right.
Got it.
Right. So great point, Joanna. I'm actually looking for, and actually that scholar in me engaged as soon as I heard that. And so I'm immediately looking at patterns, thinking about patterns. Is this yet another pattern that's sort of evolving itself or playing itself out in the larger scope of things at BYU? And that's what led me to Luke, and then Luke and I did this project jointly, and we came up with some impressive, interesting figures, I think, that are hard to refute, regardless of what folks are saying about all the numbers are flawed or whatever. It's hard to refute. It's hard to refute.
Well, in the case of athletes, because you don't have any data for how many
non-athlete
kids at BYU are getting kicked out privately. And the reason they're private is they haven't signed a scholarship. They're not in the sports pages to where their absence on the field or dropping from the team has to get done. So we really don't know the wider stuff. But you're saying at least it's impressive numbers when it comes to the athletes.
Right. I was going to mention also, but recognize that white athletes who play sports at BYU, who get into some troubles, have greater systems of redress in place. They have bishops to go to. They can go to their home bishops. They can go to their university bishops. There's a system in place to help them to deal with whatever indiscretions it may result, because of some so-called transgression.
So when you summarize stats for black athletes, I mean, Davies was raised LDS, right?
That's correct. By the way, speaking of which, Joanna, you may be interested to know this. He was actually adopted, and there's a whole story there about the fact that his adoption. So even though he's an quote unquote African American, his experience in Provo is anything but black in the sense that he grew up white. So he's not a disrespect. I'm not trying to disrespect him. I'm just saying that he is essentially socially white.
We can get into that later.
Okay.
That's an interesting wrinkle because I don't, certainly, it should be said for the record, Darren's an expert on transracial adoption. He's written a manuscript on that as well. But we could split hairs over whether, if you look like a black man in America, you get treated like a black man in America.
I just had to mention that. I just had to say it.
You're not going to argue with me about that.
No,
right?
I just want people to understand, just because you look like me doesn't mean you act like me, right? Your experiences are very different. So
back to the numbers, though, I mean, when we see this pattern of black athletes having a higher rate of honor code enforcement, right? Or of having higher rate of honor code penalization than we have documented for white athletes. Do the numbers break out similarly along LDS, non-LDS lines? Because you can't say all black athletes are non-LDS. The majority are, correct?
That's correct. That's correct. Yeah. In fact, just let me mention this to you. There's been some, from what I understand, I'm not in Utah right now, but what I understand the systems in place have been mobilized, and they've sort of sent out some current athletes or former athletes who happen to be black to sort of quench the firestorm going on here. And they were saying, well, we're black and we haven't had any problems there, but at BYU, it was a good experience for us. But recognize they represent the minority. The vast majority of African-American athletes that play at BYU are non-Mormon.
Right.
It's hard pressed to find a Mormon black athlete anywhere in the country, that would potentially even want to come to BYU for that matter.
So we might say there's then a double aspect of difference here.
That's correct.
These aren't just black athletes. These are also black non-LDS athletes who were recruited in. Right. So there's a double difference.
Right.
Okay. And then, you and I, so the article came out, you did radio in Utah, and it went viral really quickly. We chatted a little bit about this, you and I, right after it went out.
Well, let me tell you something. I never expected that. I didn't expect it to be what it has become. And obviously, it struck a nerve with folks. So, but that's actually a good thing, because at least it sparks conversation around these issues, if nothing else.
I mean, and I think we want to go there for the larger part of the show, but when we were talking briefly online, and Dan, I know I need to be quiet because you're aching to get in.
No, it's cool.
we had a little Facebook chat, and you said to me, why do you think it's blown up like this? And I said, well, why do you think? A, sports. Sports drives more traffic on the internet than almost anything. Mm. B, that race and sex combo. And that C, it's about Mormons. And there's a pattern, right? People are used to associating. People have a hunch, especially African-American people have a history of, and have good reason to think of the church as having a history of racial problems.
Right.
So it fulfilled that expectation where in some ways everyone's easiest, we're a very easy target, the church is, unfortunately, on issues of race because of our history. But, that's pretty much, I think, why it went viral. Have you got any other insights, Dan? Darren?
Not really as to why, other than we're still real close to Jimmer Fredette and the whole Brandon Davies and what could have been for BYU perhaps. So I think that certainly is still out there. But anyway, there was a couple of questions that did come up for me, Darren. When you talked about, so for instance, when I looked at the 67 athletes that you sort of had on the little profile of what their thing was, a lot of them you couldn't determine their religious background. So the Mormon, non-Mormon thing that Joanna's brought up is still fuzzy. We don't really know the data, right?
Yeah, we actually have the breakout on that. I mean, the ones that are public knowledge, we actually know who's Mormon and who's non-Mormon.
But it wasn't all those, the 70 that you mentioned, though.
Right. What we don't know, however, is who's necessarily all black and who's all white. We don't necessarily know all that.
Okay.
And what we couldn't verify, we didn't include in the tally. So it was that simple.
Right.
So we want to keep our numbers as accurate as possible.
Okay. Now, as a way to get back into the actual gist of the article, you mentioned the areas of redress or the avenues of redress that we have for the Mormon students or for the white students that seem to be, at least, I guess you're saying even the non-Mormon white students are socializing in Mormon wards because you said that they have a bishop or somebody that knows them. I know that BYU in 2005 added some sort of chaplain to deal with non-LDS kids in the sports programs.
That's correct.
So tell me, I mean, that's a step forward. I imagine you're applauding that.
Yeah, because...
Not the same thing?
It's not enough. It's certainly not enough. And even though the chaplain that they have doing it, who's currently in place now, is a great guy. I actually know him personally. and I've actually worked with him before. He's a really good guy, and he's got a great heart. And I know he cannot stand a lot of the things that have been going on. But I think they were wise to put him there. But I think it's not enough. I think in addition to that, if it's okay if I move in that direction just a little bit, I don't want to pull away from where you got folks are going. But I mean, more needs to be done than just having a chaplain in place to sort of mentor students of color. Right. I mean, they need to have more than just that.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
So what I'm guessing, though, when you bring up the bishop, you know, there's these processes the bishop was. Probably a lot of it to me is familiarity. Well, I've seen this guy. I know this kid. I know his heart. And somehow that must have a more clout when it comes to the honor code. Because certainly you're not going to say that if you're breaking the law and you're white, you might not get suspended or kicked out the same way if you're black. But you're must thinking that it must be that area where, well, I'm making a recommendation based upon knowing this kid, and they're going to go lighter on this kid if he's a white kid because of the bishop and the whole, hey, we're all Mormons, and the spirit has testified to me that this kid's heart's right, and he's going to go places, versus you're saying that the relationship with the chaplain isn't, it couldn't have that same kind of clout, because there's going to be the cut and dried cases.
Right.
But
right.
Then is it this middle that you're talking about?
Well, yeah, I mean, truthfully, and this is. I mean, I think bishops on campus, at least the ones that I've spoken to about this, have said, if you want to keep a kid at BYU, you don't send them to the honor code office. I mean, the honor code office on campus by many bishops is known as the Gestapo. No one sends kids to the honor code office who you think have a future and who you want to see succeed and go on and matriculate at the school. I mean, that's common knowledge. And so whereas white kids have these hopefully sympathetic individuals in place to sort of help them get through whatever issues that they're experiencing, African Americans have to rely on a chaplaincy system where the degree of social distance between the chaplain and these African American athletes is great. And what I mean by social distance is that many whites in this country don't even have any significant friends of color. Right. They have no clue about what it means to be black or Asian or Latino, because whites, being the largest group still, even though it's declining, still are the biggest and isolated group in the nation. So whites don't have significant friends of color. I have to have white friends because I'm a man of color living in a white world. So I have by virtue of my position, I have to work with white folks. But white folks don't necessarily have to work with me and become my friends. So the same thing is true, at least in this context, with African American athletes and the social distance theory that I'm putting out there. So even though the chaplain has a role to fulfill, the fact of the matter is he knows very little about these individuals until they are brought to his office, and then he has to render judgment based upon a number of things. And because of, by virtue of his position and where he is in the administrative chain, right, there's a direct pipeline between him and the honor code office. Whereas that's different from an ordinary student ward and student stake.
Okay. And well, let's go ahead. I'm sorry, go ahead. Dan, go ahead.
No,
let's not forget too that, the chaplaincy is not, or the bishop is not the only way that someone gets referred to the honor code office.
That's correct.
As long as the honor code office accepts third party reports, that compounds the dynamic. And if someone is already marked as different in a community, even if there has been a friendship, a relationship, a boyfriend, girlfriend relationship, it's just more likely, and this is not specific to Mormons, this is about hundreds of years of history in the West, that, the person who is different will not have the same degree of social support, and that they will be made vulnerable and exposed more quickly, right? So if a black kid screws up in Provo, someone may report them to the honor code office who doesn't have their best interests at heart, who is reacting, in a way that's been patterned or conditioned, by hundreds of years of culture in the U.S. that have taught us to see black folks as other or as different. So, that happens as well, I'm sure, in some of the cases that you've studied.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And I would argue that most of this is exactly what you're saying. But folks aren't aware of that, though. Folks aren't aware of how unconscious bias speaks them, they have no clue about what that looks like. They react to these like issues of, with Davies or some of these other issues that went on in 2004 and 2005. So basically, I'm acting on biases that sort of speak me, or I'm reacting to biases in which I've been conditioned to see the black body.
Right.
As a very different kind of body in comparison to whites. Absolutely.
I mean, who are you? Yeah. Who are you more likely to turn in? Someone that looks like your brother, or someone that doesn't necessarily look like your brother and who hundreds of years of legal, political, cultural, artistic information have conditioned you to suspect and fear? Right.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Good. We're starting to head into the broader issues. Let's go back to a few more things in the article, if we could.
Okay. Sure.
For instance, again, I wanted to just clarify one more time. We sort of have this middle ground that you're talking about, the chaplaincy versus the other thing, because as somebody looked at the stats of the 62 or the 67 that were in your gallery, 85% of them actually broke the law. Somehow or other, there's an arrest, you know, whether it's alcohol, prescription drug, check forging, you know, theft, or the rape allegations, stuff like that. Those would you claim that there's even the difference between the black athlete and the white athlete going there versus, because like with the Brandon Davies thing, again, no one's really come out and said it, but it's fairly speculated that there's a pregnancy that somehow was going to come out, and mm-hmm. that's what forced that action. In this case, when you break the law and, you know, I don't know, freedom of information or however the law, you know, stuff gets into the sports pages, those are going to be different things, and BYU kind of has more of an automatic process. Mm-hmm. You're suspended from school. We invite you back at a certain point if you want to. You know, I imagine there's some behind-the-scenes things. If this is your fifth or sixth sort of warning, probation sort of thing with the honor code, maybe they don't invite you back. But there is sort of a difference there when those who broke the law versus the ones that maybe are a little bit more like, gee, do I report that this guy has confessed to me that he had sex with his girlfriend?
Mm-hmm.
So is that okay? So it's not always race, or is it?
Well, I think it's both. I think it's always race and always not race. I think race is one of those. I mean, we are conditioned to see gender, class, race, and difference. And these are constructs that speak us in ways that we're unaware of unless we do the difficult work of becoming aware of them. So yes, I think it's all of those things, and they're and not all of those
okay.
things.
That's
if I
fair.
Can just frame that too, if I can just add one other layer, and this is something I wrote about when I dealt with this, when I did a follow-up on Darren's story at Religion Dispatches, is that, you know, you have to paint this against, I mean, good point. And people, you know, there's no arguing the fact someone gets arrested, except for, you know, we live in a country where young black men are disproportionately criminalized. You know, young black men represent a disproportionate share of the prison population. There's histories at play whenever police interact with people of color, especially with young black men. So even law enforcement, certainly law enforcement, is not a level playing field. There's race at work there as well. And the way I put it in my article is, you know, in a place like Provo, trouble is going to find black kids fast. And that's the truth for almost any majority white community in the United States, and in truth, almost anywhere in the United States. The way scholars of race talk about it, and for folks who don't know, I've studied race for 15 years as part of my day job, but you know, the way scholars of race talk about it is in terms of vulnerability. People of color are more vulnerable to criminal prosecution than white people in America. And that's just kind of statistically documented. It's just kind of received knowledge and understood among sociologists, criminologists, that it's different.
Right.
It's different.
And it's been well studied and well documented.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean that people of color are committing more crimes necessarily. It just means they're getting caught a lot more.
Right. Well, obviously, if you've been socialized and conditioned to see difference and see other, right, you're going to be watching folks of color more readily than you would be watching white folks, right? So if you're watching more folks of color more readily, you're going to see crime being committed. So if you're socialized to see difference as criminal or sexual or whatever the adjective is, you're going to spend your time focusing on or watching those individuals more closely. I would argue, and that's been well documented as well. And so I think that lends credibility to the studies that have been done on criminality and race. So, and this is exactly the point that I'm getting at in terms of this whole honor code system, is that if you're focusing on the few, you're going to see the few committing acts of whatever, or acts of transgressions with the honor code, you're going to zero in on them. You're going to focus on them more. And guess what? You're going to find things if you're watching. If you're focused on difference that way, you're going to find acts of honor code violations. I just certainly agree with that.
And I agree. And I think that's probably the number one positive takeaway from this whole process, this whole discussion you've started, I think. We'll begin to have a more productive discussion because of it.
Let me add this little bit in there. What's interesting about this, and I'm sure Joanne, you can probably chime in on this as well, is how another way in which we've been conditioned as Americans is through the tenets of what I call the tenets of liberalism, right? One of those tenets being individualism. I've heard so many people comment and saying, well, those young men knew what they were doing. They signed that honor code and they knew what they were doing, and they have responsibility, squarely putting it on the shoulders of the young men. Now, I'm not denying that they signed the honor code and so on and so forth, but I'm also acknowledging that they're 18 years old as well. And they're 19 years old, and they're coming from a different context. Yeah. They're coming from a different cultural context into a predominantly white, highly religious community who has zero tolerance for these kinds of things, typically. Right. And so people don't take that into consideration. They just assume, well, you knew what you were doing when you were coming here. Well, the university did not make any systems in place to help these young men to be successful, any mentoring programs or anything in place to help these young men to be successful. So essentially they set them up, if you will, to fail.
Yeah, that's a big part of your article. Let's talk a little bit more about that, and also if things have changed from the Croton era to the Mendenhall era, because I've heard Bronco and his, you know, I mean, I'm a sports radio guy when I'm driving and things like that, and Bronco will be on, he says, you know, if we're recruiting non-Mormon athletes, we really are now recruiting those who at least have good, strong religious backgrounds, who, you know, there's enough culture shock in Provo when you're a different color. You know, we don't want to add, you know, not only a different color, but you know, this attitudes towards sex and things like that. So he's at least saying we're no longer recruiting the way Croton was, who I'm sure, you know, these 14 athletes and stuff, apparently a lot of these guys were really amazing athletes, and they were looking for the success on the field and just hoping for the best for the rest. And like you say, Darren, there probably wasn't great, you know, services in mind to really tell them what they're into. So the whole bait and switch, setting them up to fail thing, I'd love you to go a little bit deeper and you know, is BYU at least in the right trajectory? Are they jumping at least in the river to do better?
Well, it as you indicated, I think it appears that under Mendenhall's watch, I think that they are making some efforts. Now, if you want to say that one of those efforts that they're, you know, one of those moments, if you will, is just not recruiting African American athletes, just don't recruit them or recruit less, then that's certainly a strategy. But you know, but if as long as you have African American athletes on campus, you have a responsibility to have systems of play in place to help them be successful. And I don't see that. I think they have Jamal Willis working there right now. I think he's doing something. Now, he's a former athlete that played there several years ago. I think he works in the athletic department doing something. And I think they have a few others, isolated individuals around in the athletic department helping out just as a presence. But if you have black players and black students, for that matter, on a predominantly white campus, you have a responsibility to have black administrators, black faculty, black coaches, a whole black infrastructure to help even 50 or 40 students to be successful. Right. And BYU hasn't done that. They have not made any efforts to do that, actually.
That really struck me. I mean, just, again, my day job, I'm an educator, and I happen to, you know, teach at a university where we are 54% students of color, and I'm very proud of that. But even at San Diego State, 54% students of color, you know, we have to do a better job providing mentors, role models, support systems. That's just how we talk in the education field. And to be at a campus where it is 0.6% African-American, where there are 176 black kids out of 33,000, you know, that has a major, major impact on students of color. I've seen it in my classrooms. I've seen it in departments I've administrated. I just have to underscore that. It's a serious issue. It really impacts outcomes, you know, for success.
Oh, absolutely, and again, and I think BYU's had in the past, they've had some some exceptional black folks on campus that could have really made a significant contribution. One being Darius Gray, taught there several years ago. I think back in the 70s that Darius taught there, was working at BYU. I mean, he was a tremendous role model. I don't know why they let him go. Obviously myself, I'm biased that way, but I taught there and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Here's the question I think Dan was getting at, though, too. You know, Darren, like, so it's a very, very white school. You know, what ethically? I mean, and that's, I got some pushback on Twitter when I posted the articles from folks who were saying it's different now under Mendenhall. I said, okay, that's good to hear, but you still have this issue of an overwhelmingly majority white school. So what, you know, if we're going to play on BYU's side a little bit in this, you know, what should BYU ethically do? I mean, it doesn't help matters to stop recruiting black kids.
That's been the strategy. I mean, since Mendenhall came in, one of their strategies has been, let's just not recruit blacks, you know, or if we do recruit blacks, let's recruit blacks who are more like us and less like them. Right. You know, them being the ones who were in the photo gallery. A lot of those kids in there who had issues there in Provo. So let's go after kids like Brandon Davies, for instance, who's one of us, who's part of the community, et cetera. So I think that people want to believe that the institution is doing something good. And I think they've made efforts to. I think what you have is you have Bronco Mendenhall coming in, you know, basically not playing around, you know, kicking folks off, disciplining folks. I mean, laying the law down, whereas his predecessor didn't do that, i.e. Gary Croton. So I think that you've got a personality that's better at personnel management than his predecessor. But that doesn't lend itself to institutional support. Right, he doesn't have larger institutional support. What you just said earlier, Joanna, about the infrastructure that needs to be in place, whether it be 50 athletes, 20 athletes, even one athlete, they have to have greater infrastructure, i.e., being administration, faculty, staff, and support staff around to help, so that men of color and women of color can see successful role models at the university doing successful things. And there's being a term, mentors.
There's a term we use in education called, you hear the term critical mass. Mm-hmm. And this is a term that's a legal term that's been used in when, you know, court cases over affirmative action have been adjudicated. The notion that in order for any institution to be plausibly hospitable to people of color, there has to be a critical mass of people of color, just because of the way race is lived in America and the fact that people of color feel oftentimes more safe in the company of other people of color. And, you know, I'm just trying to imagine what that horizon would even look like for BYU, if that's even attainable. I mean, because I want to, like, give BYU a fair shake and let's, you know, the benefit of the doubt. Like, what if BYU wanted to work its way out of this problem? You know, could they ever attain critical mass?
I think they could, but I don't think they really care much about it. I mean, look at their positions on most of these issues. What do they typically do when issues like this blow up in their face? They usually mobilize Kerry Jenkins. She's the first one they mobilize, right? She'll go online and she'll speak, or she'll go to the papers and make some comments. But do they ever really change and really move in the affirmative toward redressing these issues?
Okay, well, I mean, at least the chaplaincy and like you say, Jamal Willis.
Those are modest, though, Dan.
Okay.
Let's move on.
Well,
Dan, where do you want to go next?
Well, I wanted to kind of get into this because, Darren, basically a takeaway from your article is, you know, hey, black athletes thinking of coming to BYU, think again, don't go.
Don't come.
And so you're kind of
saying that, actually. I didn't say that.
But it's there. You know, it's clearly going to be the result of this article in many ways. And yet at the other time, if we want BYU to move forward and you say that your general life's work is to eventually, you know, have the whole LDS church reform, you know, and apologize for its past racist, you know, stuff. And you know, the whole history of you want to bring this up in a broad way. And in some ways, this article is going to serve against BYU having more and more reasons to move better in this direction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, what's different, in yesteryear, when this issue came up in the 60s, late 60s, is miles, they were miles ahead then than they are today, believe it or not, in terms of what they did in the 60s when this came up. Because this came up again in the 60s, in the late 60s, when all the protests went on at different various schools. I think Oregon State, Stanford, UTEP. Wyoming,
they wouldn't play. Yeah.
They wouldn't play us in basketball.
No, they wouldn't compete against BYU. And there were major riots and protests that went on, student riots and protests that went on when BYU showed up to play. And so, but I don't know if you know this, but actually BYU opened up the campus to bring in these various schools to show these schools that we're not racist, right? And what BYU skillfully did, I think, is they separated church doctrine from the campus climate at BYU. They skillfully did that, right? They said, well, yeah, the church has its doctrine, but we don't, but we feel that all men are equal and all men have potential, blah, blah. And they use Book of Mormon scriptures to do that. But I think that that was a good thing to do for them. But again, what they didn't do is they didn't follow it up with hiring more faculty of color and more infrastructure. They didn't do that. And that's what is problematic.
Okay.
I don't want to beat that dead horse, but it's important change to occur that way.
I want to talk, Dan, are you ready to shift onto kind of the broader conversation about race and not talking about race?
I do, unless Darren wants to highlight a few things in the article. I mean, there was the whole sense of, you know, these recruiting trips that make it, you know, whether that they really knew and what they were getting to. Maybe we'll just let people read the article for those. But the whole idea of...
And you looked at some of the early black folks ordained to the priesthood, didn't you?
Who, me?
Yes, you.
Well, you know I want to go there, Joanne. But you know, but we don't have to go there.
Okay. All right. Go ahead. Next topic. Well, that's interesting. Wait a minute. So you're saying I'm wrong in what I've gathered from Margaret Young and everyone else that there were early black ordinations?
Oh, so you want to go there?
No, I'm curious. Educate.
Yeah. Oh, wait. I mean, you mean yeah? In terms of Elijah Abel and Walker Lewis?
Yes.
Yes, of course. Yes. I mean, I don't know if many church members know that realize that there were black men ordained to the priesthood.
Well, that's what I brought up. I said you didn't mention them at all in your. I mean, the way you put it was like, of course Mormons are racist. They've thought that black people are subhuman, and they've always never ordained them. And I'm like, okay, hold on. We've done better than that within our own culture, at least within progressive Mormons. We've said, you know what happened? There were black folks who were ordained, and there were some very human decisions, under the leadership, during the Nauvoo years related mm-hmm. to some scandals mm-hmm. when, black folks stopped being ordained and that was institutionalized. I mean, we find black ordinations of descendants of Elijah Abel as late through the late 19th century. And then there's this institutionalization of regressive racial policies, and I think that's important because it humanizes. It's important for Mormons to talk about our history that way. It's important for the public to know that, just because it humanizes the poor, what I view as the poor choices of, prior leaders of the church in acceding to the general racism of the United States in our own internal policies. It humanizes those choices. And folks who want to say this was always the will of the Lord need to think twice when they look at our actual history. Correct?
Mm, indeed. Absolutely.
So you just skated over all that.
No, I mean, I didn't know what you guys wanted to go there. You guys wanted to
in the article, in Deadspin.
Okay. Well, we didn't have enough space for all that.
Okay, well, next time I dare you to find a one-sentence word. Mormons had it right at one time.
We did. We did. Joanna, I mean, and the thing is, you're exactly right. And that's the hope that keeps me here, is looking at that past, looking at the progressiveness of that past, right? That Mormons made some incredible institutional decisions when others – didn't have nothing to do with black folks, but yet Mormons were making these powerful decisions that mainline Mormons forget.
Yeah. I just want mainline Mormons to have to know that. And there are a lot of mainline Mormons that read your piece. And when they see, there is racism in Mormonism. It is there are particular forms of Mormon racism.
That's
and
correct.
I want to keep pushing that dialogue along. So, my challenge when I write for the public, and this may be, Dan, this will help us segue to this question of how do we write about and talk about race and Mormonism, and what does it mean to out Mormon problems in public? Right. But mm-hmm. when I write about Mormonism for the public, I'm always trying to give the most accurate version of the problem as I understand it, both as a service to the inside and a disservice to the outside. I don't always do it perfectly. That's just a human flaw. But, you know, when we dumb down our own history, we let folks who are still kind of embedded in the Orthodox Church know less about where we come from and be less accountable. So I'm just pushing you on that. Next time you write about this, get that sentence in there that says, we had it right at one point and we screwed up.
I will do that.
Thank Good, you.
Yeah, yeah, because there are two paragraphs where you deal with the whole theology, and you know, you go into, you know, Brigham Young's statements, and you go into the Nephites and the Lamanites and all that stuff, and I think it could have easily gone in there too.
Well, just so you know, just because I don't want to get this out there, I did put that in there, but it was cut.
Okay, and that was part of my question. That was part of my question of how much control did you have over the final product? Because I was wondering about stuff like that, because I knew you were aware of it. And it's so interesting that this last little 5-minute segment here, when you guys said, "Oh, you want to go there or whatever," I was talking for like 30 seconds with my mute button on, so I was trying to take us down a different path. But I'm glad that we were able to get through that.
That was funny. But okay, but can we go to this point now? Dan, I barely let you get a word in edgewise, but should we talk about what it means to write about Mormon problems in public?
Yeah, I that's fine. The only thing I was going to just bring up was some of the other criticisms of the article.
Do it.
Well, just for instance, and Darren, the way you handled this on like the Gordon Monson show on one of the local stations was a lot of people were saying, why, you know, this story only contains the black kids who have an axe to grind. You didn't talk to Reno Mahe and various, you know, black athletes that are having great times. You know, we had Curtis Brown, who was also on that same radio station. You had Brian Keel. They aren't part of this, and you said that they are part of your larger book, your larger project, that you want their stories to be told. So in some ways, I guess that was another part of my, like, was Deadspin forcing you to take out the more balanced perspective here? And did they have the headline, "The Truth About Race, Religion, and the Honor Code at BYU"? Because those are kind of statements to me that don't suggest fair play.
Or good journalism.
I think
that the story that was done was a good story that looked at all factors. And the truth of the matter is that the students of color who are being casted out, that is the story. That is the story. I mean, and it's more of them that are being thrown out than folks like Brian Keel or Curtis Brown or some of the other or even Reno Mahe for that matter. You know, so I think that the story, the most important piece of the story, is the disproportionate amount of African Americans that are being thrown out versus non-African Americans or Polynesians or other populations that we name in the article. That is the story.
And of athletes, because we have no clue about how many kids it was. Kerry Jenkins said something like up to 3.5% of BYU students, you know, are honor code violated out of school each year. Mm-hmm. So we know that there's, you know, I guess what would 3.5% of 33,000 be?
I think she said 3.5% have contact. Contact with the honor code office each year.
But we don't know how many are disciplined out of school. Okay, no. But certainly, probably the strong average is if you did have sex with your girlfriend, or if there's a pregnancy or something, you're going to be suspended, and perhaps you'll be invited back, perhaps you won't. So we don't know that much. Okay, so that's one thing.
And I guess part of the issue here is that when you look at the honor code system and how it's applied, it's not, and I guess the take home message here in terms of the, if you're asking me, well, is it fair? Absolutely, because if you look at the numbers bear out that there's something afoul. If you run afoul of the honor code office, there are consequences, particularly if you're a black man, right? There are consequences for you. But I think the issue here is that BYU, for whatever reason, I don't think it really considers race that much of an issue when it comes to honor code, how to go about applying discipline to athletes who run afoul of the honor code. So what you have is you have a two-tiered system. You have a two-tiered system, whereas it's not universally applied in each incident, right? So if you have a white athlete committing a violation, and if you look at some of the gallery photos and some of the things that we discovered, you'll see some similarities in criminal behavior committed by white folks, right? And those committed by black folks, but yet white folks didn't get kicked out.
Okay, right? But we don't know, always know if there were five warnings ahead of time.
Before the big thing.
Yeah.
But we can only assume that they went to their bishops or they went to their clergymen and had some discussions and were put on probation or maybe given a second chance. We can only intimate from that based upon what we read. That's all we can do.
All right, so, cool. And let's go to the broad issues. That's really where we wanted to go to.
Before we leave the Rogues Gallery.
Okay, go ahead.
You know, I've come out strong in writing, and I think listeners on this podcast will think in terms of race, just, you know, trying to support what I think was some of the good, important work Darren did in talking to these young men of color and representing their point of view. But at the same time, you know, I just walk away from the whole thing kind of as a Mormon feminist saying, oh, wow. I mean, I know that just straight up exploitation of women is a part of college football. I mean, everywhere. It's a part of college sports everywhere. But, you know, the sense that there was like actual procurement of females happening, you know, not under Mendenhall, but before that, you know, to allure players to BYU and the violence against women. I mean, please let no one confuse my criticism of racism with a lack of criticism of the straight up misogyny that still is just rampant in college sports. Okay, next topic.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely
cool. Good. Well, Joanna, why don't you go ahead and frame, get us into the larger framing here, what you're about doing. Yeah.
Yeah. When Dan and I talked about this podcast, I mean, one of the good things about, you know, the Mormon Matters podcast is we get to reflect a little bit more. You know, this is not a talk radio experience. You're talking basically to Mormons who are, you know, engaged and concerned and informed. And so we're going to take a step back and just reflect more broadly about what does it mean to break a story like this for the public? You know, what does it mean when Mormon issues with racism are put out in Deadspin versus in Sunstone or on the Mormon Stories podcast? You know, what happens? You know, for those of us who are interested in advancing a progressive agenda within Mormon culture, you know, what are the pros and the cons of taking it to, for better or for worse, national press, like this story went? And I'd be interested in hearing you reflect on that, Darren. I mean, because certainly there's a lot of charge that surrounds anytime BYU is covered in a negative way or anything Mormon is covered in a negative way in the national press.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a great question. I think that many Mormons would see it as an attack on Mormonism, the very foundation and fabric of Mormonism, because it's not in a sanctioned text or a sanctioned church authorized medium. And so certainly with Deadspin or any other medium for that matter that's not church approved, it's automatically dismissed as being an anti piece, you know, and certainly some of the emails that I've got sort of reinforce that. But I think that members need to look at that, need to redress that issue, or at least need to reframe that issue, because that's not always the case. I think that in this piece was not designed to malign BYU. I want to be clear on that, or the church, or anything like that. This piece merely pointed out discrepancies in honor code violations based upon a tally that was done from 1993. I mean, that's really what it was about. And just so happens there were discrepancies there that needed to be brought to light. Now, if I could have brought this to light in a university in the university paper at BYU, I would have been happy to do it. Or any other way to show BYU, hey, listen, you know, you may have some disparities here, but I know I wouldn't have got that audience. I mean, they wouldn't have given me that platform, because they're all about suppressing this kind of information and suppressing anything that may seem overly damning to the institution. And that's unfortunate, because this is the very information that could help reform the school in positive ways, I think.
So
right.
Go ahead.
No, I was just the term strategic. Yes, you have more impact this way, but is it strategic to actually get the church to move in a direction? There's the embarrassment strategy. There's the, you know, catch them with their pants down kind of thing. But at least my sense of the entire, you know, that's not the way to get things done effectively within the church. Maybe it's the way to have a good discussion at first, but I sense that a lot of times they'll put their guard up versus a way of, you know, addressing it more privately.
Dan, I've tried it both ways. I mean, when Black and Mormon came out in 2004, I actually went to church offices and actually spoke to a general authority about that, because I really wanted this to be something that they could be proud of and something they could sort of look at their history and say, okay, listen, we need to continually make efforts to improve our image and improve the number of representations that we have of folks of color in significant positions of authority and leadership, ecclesiastical leadership opportunities, and so on and so forth. But no, institutionally, it seems to me, I could be totally wrong about this, but my experience tells me that I'm not, they don't care one way or the other. They don't care about it. They don't care about the negative press. They don't care about whether or not someone like myself or others are ranting and raving because there's discrepancies and honor code violations based on race and based on Mormon versus non-Mormon. They don't seem to really care until there's pressure mounting upon them, public pressure, to do something. And even then, it's a crapshoot.
Who did you envision as the ideal audience for this article then, Darren? Like, who were you writing it for?
This audience was written strictly for Deadspin readers, who are sports junkies who like to read sports blogs. I mean, this was written for them. Like I said, I didn't have any idea that this thing would take off the way it did. I just didn't think it. Who would have known that Mormons would have been at least bit interested in this because they would have perceived it as being overly anti. Is my point?
Come on now, we are a defensive, historically insular, chronically misunderstood religion. We have a 55% approval rating in the United States, according to the Pew Foundation survey, which puts us right about in the same neighborhood as, you know, our Muslim brothers and sisters. And anytime bad press comes out, or it doesn't even have to be bad press, anything that smells like it's not correlated, people flip. You know that. You know that from being in Utah, right? I mean, people flip
out. It must have been my naivete then, because I really didn't think that people would react the way they did to this article. I really didn't think that they would. I'm glad that they did, because at least it gets people thinking. But I didn't think that it would be the talk of the town. I mean, this thing would, the emails I got and the phone calls I got when this thing came out was incredible. But I didn't think that. So knowing that now. Right. And you're right. I mean, I know that now, and I should have remembered it from when Black and Mormon came out. That was tame compared to this.
I mean, and there's no way to reason with people who are going to say that you're anti just for telling your truth.
Right.
There's no way to reason with that. And it's no reason not to be telling your truth. And it's so difficult, especially for those of us who aren't in the hierarchy, to game the system. It never works to try and figure out, you know, like when the story about Marlon Jensen, you know, apologizing for the hurt caused by Prop 8 came out, you know, last fall, and it came out, I wrote about it, and it came out through some other venues. People got mad because, you know, the story was leaked and it ruined Marlon Jensen's chances for being a GA. You could try and strategize about how to change from the inside for decades. And that just drives you crazy. That just drives you crazy trying to figure out how to talk, you know, in a way that's going to change the leadership of the church. They have their job and they're doing it according to the best guidance they can get, right? Mm-hmm. But for those of us who write for the public, you know, I think writing on the web has made Mormonism a really interesting place to be these days. And it does give you these huge tidal waves of reaction that you never anticipated, especially in the print era.
Mm. Right. But Darren, are you worried at all, or maybe this is a strategy. I've talked openly with one of my friends who's a, you know, an activist in the GLBT stuff, and he knows that he's out there. He knows that he is being the extreme case and things like that. But it's somewhat strategic for him because he knows then there's the group of people that do have access, you know, to the people at 50 East North Temple and are working things more slowly and through the system and in the non in your face way and sort of the slower things. He recognizes that he's on the same team with them, even though he's impatient. This is his personality. This is his temperament. I'm wondering if maybe between Black and Mormon and now you have decided that I'm going to be the in-the-face guy because I know that there's the Darius Grays and others who may have access that will actually, you know, perhaps make a difference in 15 years, because otherwise I just don't see that you're, you know, I think you're going about it wrong. If Darren Smith is going to be the agent of change, you're going to be an agent of change because you're going to be the bad cop. You know what I mean, or you're gonna be the thorn in the side.
You guys have great faith in me. It sounds like to me over there.
No, I was just wondering if that's what you mean. It's like it's a patience thing. I tried it that way.
Well, it didn't work. You know, slow, steady roll has always been a white liberal, strategy that has not worked for people of color.
Okay.
Since when has that worked? You know, I mean,
but it's a white institution.
Well, that's the point I'm making. Yeah. That's the point I'm making. I'm not that. For me, Dan, I got to be who I am. I got to be true to myself. And being true to myself means that I've got to say what I got to say. You mentioned this earlier. Both of you asked me this question. You know, what was your MO for writing this piece? A lot of it was to get these young men's stories out.
Yeah.
I mean, because these young men have not been able to tell their stories, right? I mean, their stories have been created and thrusted upon them. They've never had a chance to respond in a way that makes sense. And so, partly, this story gives voice to those who were not given the opportunity to speak in their own behalf.
Yeah. And I felt that's where the heart of the story was, really, Darren. I really picked up on that when I was reading it.
Okay.
Those young men's stories really spoke to me individually and shaped the way I reacted to the story. I think Dan's question is a fair one, though, in terms of, you know, thinking not just in ways of like taking it beyond what's the best way to influence a white institutional church. Because again, I think folks who aren't part of the hierarchy drive ourselves crazy trying to figure that out. It's not our job to fix the church. It is our job to tell the truth about our lives and about our experiences in a way that's forthright and as respectful as possible. So my question then becomes for you as someone who clearly feels called to do this work, right? This mm-hmm. is part of your life work, right?
Yes.
Issues of race in the church.
Indeed.
You know, how do you think strategically about staying in the game and staying healthy and staying positive as long as possible? Because, you know, for anyone who hasn't put themselves out there on the web, it's intense and you get crazy intense reaction and that can be very distorting and very warping. So, you know, could you reflect a little bit on this experience and how you think about your long-term trajectory, you know, in terms of staying alive, taking care of yourself and telling your truth in as positive a way for as long as possible?
Well, I mean, I think I exercise a lot. That helps. I do yoga and I do Pilates. And it's just the physical things that I do. And I think that, I mean, ever since the Black and Mormon story came out back in the day, I just realized that this is for me. For me to get my story out or to tell the story of other people is extremely cathartic for me, to be able to give voice to the voiceless and to be able to put stories out there in hopes, Dan, that somebody in Salt Lake might be listening and that someone may say, wow, I'm feeling him. I'm feeling what he's saying. We got to take a closer look at this. We got to make some significant changes. Or some member who's reading this could be perhaps transformed by those experiences in a positive way to move the church forward in ways that are more meaningful for folks of color and communities of color and women as well. That's my hope and that's my commitment. Now, do I always do it in a conciliatory way? No, not all the time. It depends on how pissed off I am. This particular story.
You were pissed off. It's true.
I was extremely pissed off about this Brandon Davies thing. It really pissed me off because I think that the way that they paraded that boy around really bothered me.
I know.
I think that they're shameful for that. And I think why people are saying, well, yeah, but that was a good thing. They allowed him back on the team. No, that was an affront to his character to put him out there like that. But anyway, I think that story and other stories, I think for me, it depends on the circumstances and the conditions that sort of irritate me in terms of how I respond. Now, am I responding to the church on this? No, I'm responding to a human story that needs to be told. It just so happens it happens to be in the church that I belong to, but it's a human story nonetheless that needs to be told. And who else is going to tell the story? If these young men are not going to tell it, then someone else needs to tell it. And so I feel like it's my calling and my responsibility to do that.
Well, cool. Thanks, Darren. I really appreciate that. That was fun to hear that. And I do think everything you've said is really fair and above board, and I'm excited to have your voice in the discussion. Before we close, I just want to say, let's forget for a second the being strategic with church leaders angle, and just have a discussion, if we can, for how do we raise awareness among the general membership. For instance, you two are so alerted to the racism and the whole historical construct and all the different things, and you know, a minority and a, you know, and a population and all that stuff. What would you guys say for the best way to turn the hearts of the average member to just at least be paying attention to these things, so that when they come along a story like Brandon Davies, they'll have the reaction that Darren did, which says, okay, this isn't just cut and dried, this has a racial element probably too. There's something I should pay attention to. So what would you say? Forget being strategic with the brethren. Be strategic in wards and stakes.
Well, I think you know what you're doing right here is social media is extremely powerful and effective, and that came crashing down on me this last week, not really realizing how significant social media really is. I think what Joanna's doing with Religion Dispatches is incredibly important as well. So I think that these alternative media outlets were you able to capture an audience, a very particular audience, and sort of educate that audience around important issues is very significant and very, very important. What I'd like to see, however, is that more discussions around the issue of race within the church, because after all, I'm sure you folks are aware that there's more people of color who belong to the church outside the United States and inside the United States, and most of them have to be people of color, are people of color. So we ought to be having many, many discussions about what that looks like and what that might mean in the future, the next 20 years, for the brethren and for other church cultural issues. We're not having those conversations, and it's unfortunate. And so I think that these kinds of moments, these podcasts and other outlets are very, very helpful in that.
Cool. Anything on Sunday that we can do?
Yeah, I think it's important that we. I mean, you know, here's what I do. I'll just put it out there. When I'm in meetings, when I'm in Sunday school or in priesthood, and they're talking about some particular issue, I always try to bring it back to the human element. I always say, let's look at this from a person of color's perspective or from a woman's perspective. We can't just sort of talk about it broadly. We have to sort of focus it in. And I say that because all we ever do is talk about it in a broad sense. We never particularize it. And sort of reduce it down to a specific population. And I do that because I want people to know what it feels like or what it might feel like to be somebody who happens to be in the margins. And so, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. It just depends on the makeup of people, and it depends on what they had for dinner the night before. But I think it's certainly an effort on my part to make church more interesting, so it's not so cookie cutter. At various wards and stakes across the country.
Dan, if I could hop in here.
Please.
I don't know that I believe that Mormons are any more, that white Mormons are any more any less racist than other kinds of white people. I don't know that I could say that. And Darren says they're not, that we are not.
Good.
At the same time, we do have a history, a particular history on race. And, as someone who writes and thinks in public about Mormon issues, I never set out hoping I'm going to change anybody. I'm just trying to tell a different perspective, tell the truth as I've come to understand it, tell my truth, and hope that will do some good in the world. But, I think it would be revolutionary to see more open reflection on what led up to the 1978 revelation. There is still a lot of baggage that LDS people carry. There is still a lot of uncontested racist mythology that our people carry. And it's a shame. And the church prefers to leave the past quietly behind. I don't know that that's going to change. And as a feminist, a lot of the ways I've seen change happen is we've kind of outlived things that previous church leaders have said. We've seen this like birth control and working mothers, right? Mm-hmm. And so given that we are a culture that prefers quiescence, I mean, I don't know how we can get around and move on race. I just think it would be revolutionary if we were encouraged to reflect that maybe the problem wasn't in African American or people of African descent. The problem was in us, right? That But, you know, the problem was that we weren't reflective. We weren't asking the right questions fast enough, early enough. You know, and if we had asked the right questions fast enough, early enough, and been alert, would there ever have been a priesthood being instituted the way it was in the early 20th century? Would we have needed a revelation? I mean, and so, I mean, for me, my feeling on this has been, you know, my own testimony has been that, you know, revelation happens as the people of God prepare ourselves to ask important questions of a God who loves all people and is unchanging in that regard. You know, and so, you know, we weren't well prepared enough. That is how I have come to view, after studying prayer, the priesthood revelation. It's a responsibility of the white members of this church that things went down the way they did. So, but, you know, we don't talk about these things very openly. I don't know how we're going to get there, but I think reflecting like that would be a real perspective changer for lots of Mormons. It would be a great place for us to just start thinking about race in our own community.
Absolutely. Know? Absolutely. And I mean, I want to say well to that, because I think you're preaching right there. I mean, that's exactly the way that that's the way I see it as well. And I think that the more we have these conversations, and to the credit of members of the church, may I say this real quick? I mean, at least the ones who commented to me, the response that I've gotten has actually been more positive than it has been negative.
Well, that's important to know.
I mean, people have really sort of said, hey, this is an important topic. We need to take a look at this. See. I mean, the numbers speak for themselves. You know, we need to take a look at this. So I was very, very pleased that people were really, really, particularly on my Facebook site, people are like, just this is, are having some powerful discussions about this. And actually are standing up for justice, and I think that's what I mean, if I may, white Americans need to do that. White members of the church need to do that. This is not a black problem, you know. I mean, the problem of race in America, as according to James Baldwin, I agree, has always been a white problem. And until whites recognize that and begin to have these difficult conversations and have these transformative moments amongst themselves, rather than having me be the speaker on these issues, then we can have some real change, some real substantial change in American society and in the church. That's my hope. I mean, I stay in because of that hope. And, you know, it's people like you, Dan, Joanna, friends that I know who are LDS, who are progressive, who I say, you know, this is why I'm here. Natasha, who's here in this area, and who are thinkers, right? But yet who maintain their testimonies and who stay members of the church. To me, that's what it's about for me.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And I think the three of us, and certainly many others, are the ones who, you know, we're practiced enough, we're experienced enough, we have a broad theoretical understanding, we are able to bring it up. But then so many of them, and this is partly why I asked you about the patience, impatience question,
We
seem so many of our progressive ones as saying, you know, staying in order to be an agent for change within the church isn't satisfying to me. And that's just so sad for me, because I think they somehow think if I drop out, that's sending a message. And to me, unless 10,000 of them were all to drop out on the same day and it become a big news story, no, they're just dropping out when we need them the most. So
right.
Anyway, I'm just that whole patient, impatient. I'm not trying to judge anybody exactly, but my heart aches that so many voices that could have made a difference aren't.
Well, and I think Mormons, you know, the way all Mormons are raised to value kindness, to value pragmatism, to value community. We have so much deeply implanted motivation for truly getting along, for truly loving one another, for truly building a more Zion-like community. The problem is you can't step around something as big as the fact that we denied priesthood to worthy men of African descent for, you know, about 100 years. You can't, there's no simply leaving that behind. There must be a working through of it. And that entails, you know, that's something that impinges upon, you know, the spiritual well-being of white people just as much, if not more, as it does of black people. You know, and so we have to work through it. And I don't have an answer as to how we can work through it, given that I think most members of the church are embarrassed about our past in that regard, and don't know how to have a conversation about race in the public sphere, secular, let alone on something that's so close to our hearts as, you know, prophecy and truth.
Exactly,
you know?
The stuff it's we talked about in our last podcast, yeah.
It's so hard, it's so close to our hearts, and, you know, I just think we all need to do what Mormons should always do when they have trouble and just get to have a good cry. Because, you know, if Mormons are crying, then good stuff is happening. So let's just have a good, let's, you know. Yeah.
There's a great line from Krista Tippett after she talked about so many of these really big, powerful people that she would interview. And she would say that, yes, they acknowledge all the problems, all the ugliness. They don't turn away from it. They, you know, the full light of the sun, you know, like Martin Luther King talked about from in the letter Brigham and Jail. They've seen it all, and they don't deny it. But then the next moment they say, yes, and... And then they don't lose that ability to say, I'm going to make a difference today. So that yes, and I think we're not good enough even at saying yes. We want to be in denial of the ugliness, and it's never going to heal unless we do it. So that's certainly an attitude that I hope you know might change, and more of us will do what we can when the opportunities come. I don't know that we can really manufacture them, but I think a lot of times it can come up in the Sunday school class. Sometimes it's just going to come up in the hallways, and anything you do makes a difference.
Well, you know, it's going to happen when people die too. It's just, I mean, that's the way a lot of social change happens, first of all, but in the church, it's going, the more people who knew Bruce R. McConkie's version of the priesthood ban, you know, the more people who thought about fence sitters die, the faster change will happen.
Right.
That's just.
But it seems like that even is having said that, that the church continues to reproduce itself. It continues to call men like McConkie and others. So it continues to reproduce itself in new callings with men who are similar to the ones who are dying. So when is it going to end?
Right.
Well, I don't mean the leadership dies. I mean the body of members. Because I mean, I just mean, because I think the change is always from below in our church. It really is.
Yeah. The generation that was raised by a working mother has had an influence on some of the rhetoric, you know. Even though, Darren, you're probably right, they're going to find the most like them to call out of the hierarchy. Still, even the most like them have now had a wider life experience with working mothers. And I think the same thing's going to happen, obviously, with gay and lesbian, transgendered, bisexual people and things as well. Right. It's going to happen that way, even though you're right. They're probably going to be calling from the top. Anyway, to me, I just want to thank you so much, Darren, for coming on, letting Joanna pick your brain as well as explore the article.
Joanna's off the chain. I should have had her pick my brain a long time ago.
Sarah was off the chain?
No, you were good.
No, I know what off the chain means. I know what off the chain means.
I don't think she said, did you say off the chain? I thought it said something with brain. I didn't hear off the chain.
I appreciate the sensitivity to this, and I'm just thrilled that I have a colleague now that's a Mormon feminist who actually teaches African American feminist literature.
Yeah.
You know
what? I learned African American feminist literature at BYU from Professor Gloria Cronin. Okay.
Oh, so, you know Gloria? That's my girl.
That's strange.
I love Gloria.
Wonderful things happen sometimes, you know, at the Lord's University. And wow, let's leave it on that.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. Hate it when anybody is personally hurt. That's the scandal, you know, that's the particularity versus the universal. And I just, if my pressing thought is for these young men who had this damage, we, you know, for whatever degree we can, we're sorry. We know that that's the painful way that life works. And any of us that whenever we're tended to go to the general question, let's always remember the particular pain. And I'm grateful for the stories being told, and for that purpose that you served with this article, Darren. So thank you, and good luck with the book and all the different things you're doing.
Thanks, guys.
Cool. Good night, everyone. Thanks,
thank
Joanna.
You, Dan.
Goodbye, guys.
Welcome.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.